Hello, this is Scott Sykes, and I am pleased to welcome you to Voices from Appalachia, a new show that will feature oral histories from the Appalachian Oral History Project collection. This is a collection that was developed over several years, beginning in 1973, which sought to gather stories of lived experiences in this region, particularly in the area of Southwest Virginia. That collection is in the process of being digitized and curated in a publicly accessible online archive. This is work being done by Emory and Henry students, and I look forward to sharing many of those oral histories with you and to talking with community members and students about what we can learn and know about life here in this region as we listen to Voices from Appalachia. I'm excited to begin this new show with what I think is one of the most powerful oral histories in this collection that was conducted with a woman named Nancy Fullen Axon, who lived in the Poor Valley section of the Washington County community. We're going to listen to parts of that interview, and then I am very glad to be joined by Kathy Shearer today, who actually conducted that interview in 1973 with Miss Axon, and is going to tell us a lot about that experience and her experience with the Appalachian Oral History Project. So welcome, Kathy. I'm glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
Kathy is a well-known member of this community, a longtime member of our community, and known for her work as an historian, especially the author of several books that talk about the history of Southwest Virginia and different elements of it. But Kathy, tell us a little bit more about yourself, if you will.
Well, folks often ask when I first meet them and go into somebody's home, they eventually will ask, "So where are you from?" And I have to tell them, "Well, I must confess, I'm a Yankee." There's always sort of a gasp and then a smile, so that's okay. What brought you here? Well, I grew up in New Jersey and went to Duke University 4 years, met my husband there, Reese Shearer, and we went to Georgia in Vista. He graduated in 1969. I graduated in 70. We were in the mountains of northeast Georgia, very similar to our area here. You don't think of Georgia as part of Appalachia, but a piece of it is. And we worked down there with folks who certainly needed more income than they were getting, needed a way to survive. It was a very low-income area. We loved the folks. We loved the culture that we became familiar with. And eventually moved to Virginia. Reese is from Virginia, the other end of it, though, Arlington. So we still craved the mountains. And we settled here and were very fortunate to get involved with Emory and Henry and make good friends here among the faculty. And I was working in the library just in circulation as a part-time job when I met Dr. George Stevenson, who was just starting up the Appalachian Oral History Project. And I think his interest in me may have come from our discussion, just brief conversation, and learning that I was an English major. So he thought, okay, here's somebody who knows how to put words together. And he asked if I would help him with this project. He had students involved, certainly, but he also wanted some adults, some folks who had maybe a little more focus, wouldn't be involved in sports and all sorts of, you know, struggling through math courses and this, that, and the other. So I was glad to do that as well, also part-time. And he gave me the tools. At that time, in 1973, we're talking about a cassette tape recorder and little cassettes that go tiny little reel-to-reel and a microphone. And I think I used my own camera. He wanted pictures of the people I was interviewing. So I took those tools with me, and I don't remember him actually giving me any names of people to interview. He just said, "Go and find them." We were living in Poor Valley at that time at Hyder's Gap, and we had just moved there to a farm in 1971, so I didn't know a whole lot of people, but I met a wonderful woman who was so helpful, Mildred Kessner, who I believe had spent her whole life in that valley, and she loved the idea of interviewing her neighbors, her friends. And she said, "I'll take you to meet these people." And that's really what we needed then, because I was certainly an outsider, not let alone being a Yankee. I was somebody who had moved into the community that nobody knew. And having Mildred open those doors for me was so important. And she's the one who said, I want you to meet Aunt Nancy, as they called her. She is somebody in our community that everybody loves. And she is the person who they call on when they have an elderly person who's ill. They ask Aunt Nancy to come and stay with her. She takes care of them when they die. She takes care of the body, prepares it for the funeral, for the burial, which at that time was hand digging into the ground and putting that body in a handmade casket and all that. So she, Aunt Nancy, was loved in the community. And I just really was amazed by her stories that she told me. It was a wonderful experience.
Well, we're going to listen to a little bit of that story in a moment. Before we get to that, you highlighted Miss Axon's story in a book that you did, Working for Stewards. Can you tell us just a little bit about that project and why you chose to use Miss Axon's interview with that?
Sure. Well, after the oral history project ended in a few years, I went on to a variety of other kinds of work, mostly working for People Incorporated, a community action agency helping people get indoor plumbing, a great need in our county, our area, and didn't really do anything with oral history for many years. But I started meeting people through People Incorporated, through my work, who also had great stories to tell and wonderful pictures. And I started collecting those, and I started working up in Dant and the coal fields. And we started a history project there, and it just got more and more. It spoke to me more and more. And eventually, I helped the people in Dant at the Senior Citizen Center put together a series of stories and pictures, and we hung them on little quilts that they'd made and moved it all around the area, and it was a huge success. And then one of the ladies who had quilted and told me stories, Lucille Whitaker, she said, honey, that's real nice, but where's the book? I want to see a book. And I said, Lucille, I have no idea about writing a book. I've never done that. She said, well, you've done these little stories. You put that together. Come on. And I said, a book is so expensive. I was still working for People Incorporated then, and I had a full-time job. And she said, well, I'll see what I can do. And she went door to door in her town of Dant, Virginia, old coal mining town, and she brought me $800. She just said to people, we need a book. And, of course, that was just the drop in the bucket for printing the book and all that. But still, I knew that I was hooked. I had to do it. So I got permission from Rob Goldsmith, a well-known person in this community whose father taught in the English department. I got permission from the director to transition from the community housing projects that I was working on into community development, seeing this as a very important part of saving this community's history and keeping people interested in the vitality of the community. And that has actually succeeded. Since we started that project and it developed into the book, my first book, Memories from Dant, The Life of a Coal Town, then the town of Dant now has a coal miner's memorial with a lot of names of the coal miners who died in the mines and who lived and worked there, and also a housing project. The company, Clinchfield Coal Company, donated their old office building when they moved out of town to People Incorporated, and they've turned it into low-income apartments. And there are two active community organizations and a little museum. Lots has been done. So anyway, to shorten that up, it's developed into a lot of good things. And at that point, I just decided I wanted to keep writing books. And my boss, Rob, said, well, we really need you to do something else. We want to put you in the grant writing department. And I thought about that for a while. And my son said, you love writing those books. And so I left People Inc., waved goodbye after 13 years, and just I've been writing books ever since. So then to get to the Stewart Project, Stewart Land and Cattle was huge and still is a huge cattle business in Southwest Virginia. They've had land in four different counties, 45,000 acres at one time. I think they're just down to 12,000 now. So still pretty huge.
Yeah.
And during this time, I came across people in my interviews of people who work for Stewart's, I came across people who remembered Aunt Nancy. Now, she died of just a few years after I interviewed her. But the people who lived on the Rich Mountain Farm in particular talked about her and how important she was in their lives. Pretty much, she was the last black person in Poor Valley. And she lived in a holler that was full of white people, and they just took care of her as she aged out. There were two boys, teenagers probably, who came and checked on her every morning in the winter to make sure her fire was still going, make sure she had food, and everybody checked on Aunt Nancy. So it was just a real special relationship, and I thought, okay, I see a place in this book to bring in pieces of that old interview. That would be really important. And by that time, we had actually unearthed the old tapes, which were hiding away here in an office upstairs at the library. And the archivist at that time said, oh, you better not touch those. I'm afraid the tape will fall apart. And I said, but, you know, If we don't give it a try, what value are the tapes if you're never going to listen to them? And he said, well, all right, you can take that one home. And we found the one that I'd made with Nancy, and I took it home and listened to it, and it played just fine. And I was able to transfer that to a CD and bring it back and hand it to him. So that was a great moment.
Sure, yeah.
And I think after that, a lot of transcription, well, transcribing, but also just moving into a digital form, digitizing occurred. That was the start of that process.
Right, right. Yeah. And we have been happy to pick up that ball in the Appalachian Center, and we have digitized a good many of those, or our students have, I want to say.
Yeah.
And that's an exciting project.
And that's perfect for students because they are real techie.
Well, sometimes. The spectrum is wide, but it's perfect because, one, they can make so many connections with things that they are learning and discussing in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Two, they can connect with the places around the college that they might not otherwise come to know, and, of course, the people around the college like who have stories like Miss Axon did. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the first interviews that I remember listening to when I took responsibility for this collection. And it is one that I have continued to highlight through numerous programs and numerous classes. And the reaction is almost always the same. It stops people in their tracks. It's very powerful. I will say, before we listen to it, that it's a little bit troublesome or even brutal, we can say. And so if you have young children or if you're concerned about hearing a story like that, just warning that that's coming up. But it's important to hear. And everybody has agreed so. And that's why I wanted to kick off this show with this interview. You interviewed Miss Axon, according to the records, Kathy, on October 22nd, 1973. I'm just wondering if you could tell us what you remember about that encounter on that day.
Yes. Well, of course, Mildred took me there and introduced me to Miss Axon at the front door, a little wooden cabin, I would call it. And it's one that she had lived in for many years with her brother. She had been married possibly twice, widowed once, and I think divorced once. It was kind of unclear. She didn't talk about that. I've just gleaned that later. But she lived in this tiny little house, and it suited her needs. She was a quilter, and she made quilts. And I remember that on her walls were wonderful old pictures of people, I assume family pictures, and the glass that was protecting them was not flat. It was kind of a large bubble. I don't know what you would call it. But I've seen them in antique shows.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and oh, you know, I've often wondered whatever happened to those. They were treasures. And as far as we know, what the people in the community knows, she had one son, and no one knows what became of him. He left the community. They think he was in the Navy, perhaps in Norfolk, and never came back, or who knows what. But if there was any family to get those treasures, you know, we don't know what happened to them. But I remember sitting there in the house with her as she talked to me and thinking, this is, you know, this is her own little sanctuary this is where she sits and quilts and remembers her family and is, she was very religious, you know, very, just probably praying a lot, and being taken care of by her neighbors, because she had no family right there. There were other Fullans. That was her maiden name. Mm-hmm. And there is a large Fullan family still in the Meadowview area. But there's nobody up in Poor Valley mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. So she was taken care of by her neighbors, yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit about what Miss Axon had to say that day. And the story that we're about to hear can be a little bit troubling, so just warning out there if you're listening or if you have young children listening.
Mommy's older sister, Aunt Susie, old slave master in slavery time, Donald, they had a thing up in the floor, and they put their hands together and strung them up that way, you know, and beat them. The colored people, they couldn't help themselves, you know, and they get mad at one, and so the old man Henry's got mad at Aunt Susie about something. That's my granddad, my aunt, my mother's older sister. But my granddad and grandmother couldn't help themselves. They couldn't say a word. So Aunt Susie and I strapped her up and he was beating her. And she wound and twisted around some kind of way, Mama said, and kicked the old man Henry and knocked him up against the jam, kind of knocked him crazy. But he had to quit beating him and he sent down to the store and got one of the clerks in the store to come up there. And he come, and he says, I want you to finish whooping that thing. I got tired of that. Well, the blood was running down there. And he said, no, Mr. Henry, I'm not going to touch her. You just fell, take her down. I ain't going to hit her lip. So the man, now the clerk out of the store wouldn't hit anything.
So that portion of the interview comes very early on. She, at least listening to it, appeared to just kind of launch right into that. Kathy, I'm curious what was going through your mind. Do you remember?
I was startled. I think Mildred had prepared me that you need to meet this woman. She's got a terrible story to tell about slavery days. And so it wasn't too surprising, but still the details where she talks about the blood running down and, you know, and tied with a chain and all that, you rarely hear that. You hear he was beaten, she was beaten, flogged, tied to a tree or whatever. But the details that she was told, you know, as a child, because she wasn't living then. She was born a good bit later. So, you know, it was just, you know, you feel like you're right there.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel you're in that room. You're in that barn or wherever they were. Mm. Yeah, it was chilling.
And that seemed to have been a story that she had told to a lot of people.
I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was. And I think this is one of the reasons Mildred said, you need to meet this woman.
And that was kind of the question I was leading to. I was curious if you would talk a little bit about how Mildred led you to that interview. Did she say to you, there's a particular story that I think needs to be recorded, or... was there a particular point that you had in going there, and was it that story?
I honestly can't remember that. I mean, I think that was, yeah, I think she did say something about she's got stories from back in the slavery days. But she didn't get specific, I'm pretty sure. It was just, Mildred understood that being the last Black person in her community, this and someone who was quite willing to talk, that this was a very important point for my project, mm-hmm. and for all of us. You mean, you know, you just, I know I've been to presentations where somebody says, well, I met the grandson of somebody who fought in the Civil War, you know, and it's mm-hmm. like reaching back, you can touch that. I shook hands with him and his mm-hmm. grandfather, like, felt like I was touching his grandfather. And for me, that was the way it was with Nancy Fullan, mm-hmm. Axon. She mm-hmm. went by Nancy Fullan. So it was just like, I will never get this close to slavery again. I've never been this close and probably won't happen again.
Right.
You know, it's just such an amazing story. And it does make me wonder, thinking about it today, aren't there other stories like that which we're not hearing because people have just learned to keep their mouths shut?
That, or they tell a more benign story mm-hmm. about slavery, mm-hmm. if they tell it at all here. There is a dominant narrative, I think, that slavery either did not exist widely in Southwest Virginia, or at least was not as brutal a system in Southwest Virginia. And this interview is direct evidence that that is not the case, and that is not the full story. Yeah. I'm curious if any of that was going through your mind at the time, that this is different from what I might have heard before.
Not really, because I had never heard anything before. So this was my first story, and truly, because of where we live, where the black population is less than half of 1%, I haven't heard more stories like this. This is it. And I was just thinking about it over the years, I'm so proud, so pleased that she gave this to me. I was honored. Now, she was not reluctant, obviously. I mean, this came right out. She had something to tell people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's clear when you listen to the whole thing.
It is clear, right, mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. So it is just amazing. And you're absolutely right. There is this myth that slavery was very rare here. Well, actually, some of these rich farm owners, these farmers, had lots. I know Wyndham Robertson, who was a governor of Virginia and who lived at the Meadows in Abingdon, which is a place of great controversy. He, in the 1860s slave census, owned 73 black people. That isn't a small number.
No.
Now, he was one of the largest slave owners in Southwest Virginia. Mm-hmm. And by the time the Stuarts came into the picture in the farming world, slavery had ended. They didn't own land until the late 1880s, but they had owned slaves in, like, previous generations certainly had, where they came from further east in Virginia. But, yeah, there were large slave holdings in our part of the state, yeah.
That is one way that I've used this interview in classes before, is to help mm-hmm. students see part of that hidden story that they right. haven't been told, or that they don't know about, or that they know an opposite version of.
Mm-hmm.
There's also an interesting part of this interview that stood out to me when I first listened to it that I want us to take a listen to now. This is about, to continue the story for Miss Axon that she told that day. Her aunt, her great aunt Suze was beaten on that day, but sold away. She was sold off after that. And they, we can presume, had no idea what became of her. And so that was a missing part of their family for a while. And she goes on to tell us about the day that Aunt Suze came back, which we'll listen to. But before she got to that point, she shared something else that I want to talk with you about.
3 days or so, and she went away as in slavery time. Well, from how many years she was gone, Mama didn't say, but Mama was little. But anyhow, when the colored people was free, they don't know where Aunt Suze is at, where she... That man chuckled to you, but she'd been gone from grandmother and them for a long time, daughter. And grandmother and them had done moved back on the mountain on their own place and using their own name. And mom and them was great big chilling then, you know, they was free. Old man Hendricks wouldn't even down tell them when it's free. You know what he done? They come along, a man, and he said to them, do you own... know that you have the privilege of doing whatever you want to do and living where you want to. Y'all ain't in bodies no more. And Grandpa said, no, I ain't heard nothing about it. He said, well, you're free, Edmund. Go wherever you want to go. Do whatever you want to do. And build you a home of your own. Say, you don't belong to old man Hendricks no more. He wouldn't even now tell them they was free when he was.
You know, we tend now to think of history in very clear black and white kinds of episodes. This happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. But that's not the way time progresses at all. Right. And so this is another story that we don't often hear. We tend, through that dominant narrative that we've all been told, to think, well, the war ended, emancipation happened, and everything was good. But this is another piece of evidence that tells us that it was a lot muddier than that. In fact, right. people continued to suffer under a brutal system without even knowing that they had been freed from it.
Yes, absolutely. And I was certainly surprised when I heard that. But when you think about it, I mean, this was an era when it was illegal to teach a black person to read. So it was very unlikely that they would have seen a newspaper and read it. Now, word probably came around through churches, perhaps, if they were allowed to go to a church off of the farm. And, of course, you didn't have radio, you didn't have internet, you just didn't have much at all. And I would think there would be a time, during that time, the property owners, the slave owners, would be very quiet about that. And this particular Mr. Hendricks up in Russell County, this is where this was going on, he evidently just chose not to tell anybody anything. And perhaps he forbade his enslaved people to travel from one farm to another where they might hear it. And we have no idea how long it took until probably that person was from the Freedmen's Bureau who was traveling around letting people know. The Freedmen's Bureau was active here for just a couple of years. It was a very short time period. And I'm not sure how much they actually got done. But if traveling from farm to farm and letting people know what the situation was, you know, that was important. And, of course, then you have the question, which I didn't get into with her, and I wish I had, which is, how did you go somewhere? Where did you go? How did you own something? You had no money at all. You know, now some stayed right where they were, and the farm owner would say, all right, you can stay right with me. You know, I'll keep feeding you and housing you, and you work for me. And it'll just be like it was before, because you know I've taken good care of you.
Right.
So
this is how we come to the sharecropping system,
that's
which
right.
is essentially an extenuation of slavery.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they left. And as she says, we didn't take his name.
Right.
We didn't take his name. No, you know, we're not going to be Hendricks. Mm-hmm. We're going to be Fullen. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. So
I'm glad you mentioned the Freedmen's Bureau. They did do some work that's been important to us, and this is why I bring this back up. This is part of the larger what we call the Civic Memory Project in the Appalachian Center, where we're doing some digital archiving work. And we have copies of the records of the census that the Freedmen's Bureau did of all freed blacks in counties in Southwest Virginia. And our students over the last few years have transcribed some of those. And then we've had just this past year in the class of 21, one of our seniors for her senior project actually developed a website that links to the archived digital files of those census records.
Oh, great.
And then gives people some tools for doing genealogical mm-hmm. research, because mm-hmm. this is a key thing for black residents of the area who want to dig into their family history.
Right.
They, because of the system of slavery and issues with great. Names and records and inequity, that's a much harder prospect than it would be for me or you to dig into our family's history. And so that was one of the things to come out of that project, is that this can be a resource for people in the area to try to find family members.
Great. Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. You may know, I hope you know, that the Historical Society of Washington County has the cohabitation list.
Yes.
Which shows for the very first time that this man and this woman were living together as a married couple. It was illegal for a person of color to marry. And so all of a sudden, you know, now we can show, yes, 1867. And so that long list, and includes the names of all the children and, you know, everybody living in what is now their household.
Yeah.
It's an amazing resource. So, yeah, they did do a lot of good work.
The third and final sample from this interview that you did in 1973 is part of the Appalachian Oral History Project. If there can be a happy ending, we might say. There is a joyful part of this interview, and this is when this is the story that Miss Axon shared that day of her great aunt Sue's coming back.
I invite you to join us again next week on Wednesday at 1:30 to hear part two of this conversation as we listen to Voices from Appalachia.